Much of life seems to consist of change and turning points. That is probably why December of 1948 is so indelibly etched in my mind. At the time, one of my two brothers and my sister and I were living with our maternal grandparents on the Yankton Sioux Indian Reservation in southeastern South Dakota. Even though we visited our parents occasionally, we had actually lived with Grandpa and Grandma ever since Mom and Dad were divorced, about 5 years before. At one time, all four of us kids lived with our grandparents in that little three-room house. Mom lived in Sioux City, Iowa. Most of her life, she worked in the packing house or in a dry cleaning establishment as a pants presser. After the divorce, she developed an alcohol problem, which became a way of drowning out the hurt and rejection. She was of medium build, with long black hair, rough complexion, and a large nose. She, too, was rather assertive and inherited her loud voice from Grandpa. We hadn't heard from Mom for what seemed like a long time. She came home once a year or so, but didn't stay very long, just a day or two. She wrote to Grandma and Grandpa only about twice a year. Early in the fall of 1948, the packing house near where she worked had an explosion, but we didn't know if she was one of the casualties. She didn't notify us, let us know that she wasn't injured. I'll never forget the fear that came over me as we sat listening to the names of the killed and injured being read over the radio, one by one, or the feeling of relief as the announcer came to the end of the list without mentioning her name. Still, we didn't hear from Mom for several months following this event. Dad lived in Yankton, South Dakota, about 60 miles from us. He was full-blood Sioux and a member of the Yankton tribe. A handsome man with a personality that attracted women, he was of medium height and had smooth, light brown skin, dark brown eyes beneath heavy brows, and black wavy hair that he combed straight back. He was a neat dresser and always wore a suit and tie. I had never seen him in jeans or overalls. He was probably one of the cleverest persons I knew, the salesman type, but he worked at many different kinds of jobs and did well at all of them. He was a very creative person, and given a little time, he could figure out how to make or fix anything. He was a perfectionist and could prepare an excellent meal, decorate a Christmas tree beautifully, and make Christmas presents look like they were wrapped in the department store. We heard from Dad only once in a while. Being a father was not a very high priority in his life.
You've been listening to the beginning paragraphs of a memoir called Choteau Creek, A Sioux Reminiscence, written by Joseph Iron Eye Dudley, published in 1992 by the University of Nebraska Press. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. We're doing something a little bit different tonight. Usually I start by choosing a book and then finding someone to discuss it with me. For this program, I ask my guest to choose the book. My guest is Chuck Kensler. Chuck and I met at Steve Boga's Friday afternoon memoir class at the Sebastopol Community Church. The class is sponsored by the Santa Rosa Junior College. Chuck and I have been in the class for years, and you get to know a lot about people in a memoir class. And I found Chuck's story compelling, and you will have a bit of his story later in the program. But we'll focus first on the book Chuck recommended, Choteau Creek by Joseph Iron Eye Dudley. Welcome to the program, Chuck.
Well, thank you, Rosemary. Nice to be here.
Good. Choteau is a book I hadn't heard of, and I'm so glad you called it to my attention. I couldn't find out much about Joseph Iron Eye Dudley, except that he is an ordained United Methodist minister and president of Cook College in Tempe, Arizona, and a member of the Yankton Sioux tribe. I wonder if you'd share a bit of your heritage with our listeners.
Well, first of all, I'm not a Yankton Sioux, but I am a Sioux. Mm-hmm. My grandmother, she's a Yankton Sioux, sometimes called a Brule Sioux. A Yankton Sioux it's a very small reservation. It's one of the nine reservations in South Dakota, and it is found in the southeast corner. It just pushes against the Mississippi River. Biggest town is Yankton. That whole reservation is a little over 1,000 people. And it's about, 13 times bigger than San Francisco in area. So it's pretty sparsely populated. It's a little flat. Lots of birds like to fly overhead and do that Oklahoma thing, you know, where they do those slow circles in the sky. A lot of wind, but quite nice. The land, it's deep. It's rich. The people are deep and rich themselves.
And it's lightly settled.
It's very lightly settled. It's been a long time since I've been there.
Yes.
But, and I'm sure the damming of the Missouri River has changed that landscape quite a bit over the years.
Now, you mentioned that, although you're different, Sue,
yes,
that you and Joseph Iron Eye Dudley have a common ancestor.
Well, that is the craziest thing, you know, and I didn't know it until I picked up Chateau Creek and I was reading along, and it's very casually mentioned that in his background, there's a, and everyone's an Indian chief.
Yeah.
This man is called War Eagle. And War Eagle, I'm doing this on my fingers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, is my fifth grandfather removed. And it's also his grandfather. And I'll tell you how far back it goes. 1726 is when War Eagle was born. And he lived right in that area. And today there's in Sioux City in Iowa, Sioux City, Iowa, yes. There's a statue of War Eagle, and he's holding his hands up over the river, which he made his living, even though he spoke several languages, but as a transportation person going across the Missouri from one state to the next.
Well, that's an amazing coincidence.
Isn't that a coincidence?
Recognize your ancestor in this book. The Sioux language, I've heard you speak Sioux just a little bit, and I discovered that the Sonoma County Library has a CD which one can take home and learn the Sioux language. Well, I took it home and played it. I certainly, I have just that's about all I know about Sioux. But it was very, very interesting to listen to that language.
Well, it's like listening to Welsh, you know. You think, what is this? Or my father used to call it French nose, where you would pronounce certain words, and it was like the French squeezing words out of their nose. And it's guttural. There's some words that are, for me, and I've tried to learn the language, it's impossible because I've never exercised those muscles. So I can't get the word to come out.
You didn't grow up speaking the language.
Just a few words, but I didn't know. My father was fluent, and he was a Lakota speaker. His mother, who was from Yankton, was a Dakota speaker. And the third one is Nakota. So it's three different dialects. Many words are the same, but they're said differently. The men speak a dialect. The women speak another dialect. And strangely enough, because of the situation on some of the reservations are so bad where there's the death rate is high. The language is being preserved now by the women. So men are learning to speak with a woman's dialect, which can be very humorous to an elder, a man sitting there listening. And
well, one of the first things I learned from the CD is that there's a women's language and a men's language.
Isn't that right?
And I thought, this is going to be really complicated.
It is complicated.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the book, about Chateau Creek. It's a memoir, and in this memoir, Joseph lives with his grandma and grandpa in a rather primitive three-room house without electricity or running water or telephones or clocks or watches. But he never seems to feel deprived in any way. And to me, in other words, there was no whining because they didn't have any of these things. He simply talks about their life.
Isn't that rich? I think Joseph wanted some things. And, you know, on the greedy side, he enjoyed Christmas.
Oh, his stories of Christmas are just
isn't
wonderful.
That something? And what I got out of that story is Chateau Creek is just a few feet from their house. It's mm-hmm. just to the east of their little three-room house. Mm-hmm. And three rooms, they only used two of the rooms, and one was kind of a storeroom. That creek was, I think, the physical anchor in that prairie environment. It sustained them through the good years and the bad years. It flowed. It was always there, whether it be full of ice during the winter where they'd maybe have to break it open to do a little ice fishing. And in the summer, of course, it's fresh water that they had to haul to the house. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember the part about wash day.
Oh, yes.
And hauling buckets of water
yes.
to do the washing, of course.
Yes.
So I think there was that physical anchor.
Yes.
Which was the creek.
Yes.
And then there was that spiritual piece of the story that's hard yes. to put your finger on.
Yes.
The spirit that was there was certainly given by the grandfather and the grandmother.
Yes.
They did their teaching in their way without wanting a lot. So I think he got his yes. spiritual guidance
yes.
through these people, and they were pretty good people.
They were marvelous.
Weren't they marvelous?
Yes. And yes. they had once had a farm and a car and the amenities as we think of them, but they lost everything in the Depression, and that's only mentioned once.
It's mentioned once, that's right.
There's no yearning for the days when they had all those things.
That's exactly
yeah.
right. Isn't that something?
Amazing.
And then they would walk to school.
Oh, he walked 2 miles to school.
Yes.
And he said
yes.
he was the only one who walked. So you think of this little boy. He was 6 years old when he was 6, 8 years old when he
yes.
went to live with his grandparents.
Yes.
And setting out every morning to walk 2 miles across the prairie, across the hills. He mentioned the hills because he had a vista across the landscape, and he could look back and see the little house.
You're making me smile. That's exactly right.
Yeah, it's so
yeah.
beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that house was also an anchor.
Oh, yes, of course.
When I think of that.
Of course.
Because he got to the top of that hill, and
yes.
he would turn around. And
right.
I think he called the house, it reminded him of a doll house
yes.
because it was so small
so far
in the distance.
Away.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't mean to romanticize his life, but by getting all carried away about how beautiful this all was, because it was a hard life physically, and they did have deprivation, and his grandfather had a serious nosebleed one time.
Oh,
and
wow,
to,
yes.
to finally get him to the doctor and then finally to the hospital,
yes.
they almost lost him before
yes.
they could get help. So they really lived on the edge in that sense, but you never got that feeling of apprehension or unease. They simply lived the life they were living.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that nosebleed was...
Oh.
Horrible.
It was horrible. It was touch and go.
It was touch and go.
Rather they'd save
and,
him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And,
yeah.
you know, it would be like breaking your leg
exactly.
out in the middle of South Dakota. And how do you get
yes.
to the doctor?
That's right.
I believe it was during a winter months, wasn't it? And it was very difficult mm-hmm. to get
yeah.
to
but
the...
I remember a series of, quite often there was a series of what we would call coincidences that one of the neighbors, they were able to get in touch with the neighbor, and the neighbor reached someone who had a car who went for the doctor. And quite often these interventions seemed to me to be miraculous, but they were just accepted as the way life was.
Exactly.
Yes.
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 Well, you know, it wasn't just the Indian people that were living in these places, because mm-hmm. that land was also occupied by white people.
Ah.
And they were doing some farming, and mm-hmm. They were as well off as the Indians, or the Indians were as well off as the mm-hmm. white people there. It,
mm-hmm.
They were in the hard scrabble world.
Yes. I noticed that one of the first things that Joseph tells us in the book is about his family. And he talks about his two brothers, Philip and David, mm-hmm. and his sister Dorothy. And he explains why, just very matter of fact, why he's living with his grandparents. His parents are divorced. His mom is in Sioux City and his dad is in Yankton. And so I believe it was kind of on a temporary basis, because at first he and David, his
yes,
older brother,
yes.
were there. And then he just barely introduces his grandparents at this point, but then he develops them fully.
Yes.
But he starts out early in the book by saying, this year was different. And then he said, Dad called. His father had called the schoolhouse and asked someone to take a message down to the little cabin to tell them that he wanted the children to come. His dad wanted the children to come to him for Christmas.
That's right. Yes. And yes.
David wanted to go. Joseph did not want to go, but he didn't want to say anything. He just had this feeling that I don't want to go. Well, when the car showed up to take them to the dad's house, the grandfather said, Joseph will not be going. He wants to stay here. And that gave us this first inkling of the unspoken communication between these three people, the grandmother, the grandfather, and Joseph.
Wasn't that wonderful?
Yes.
That's when you go back and you reread a little bit and say, well, did I just miss something in here?
That's right.
You know, what is this silence that we are hearing?
Yes.
We're hearing that silence now.
Yes.
And the grandfather comes forth like a soothsayer. And, and he's already knowing what David is feeling.
Yes. And it's like he's reassuring David, saying, it's okay. I know what you want, and it's okay.
That's right.
Yeah.
That evening, the wind came up again, yet a stillness permeated the house. In spite of the howling north wind and all the sounds that come from an old house withstanding its force, the walls would crack now and then, the sound echoing across the high ceiling. The plastic coverings on the windows rattled and sometimes popped so loudly it seemed as though they wouldn't be in place by morning. With every burst of wind, the branches of the old box elder trees behind the house rustled and squeaked as the limbs rubbed against each other. The old quilt hanging across the doorway swayed slightly with each gust, an indication of how much wind was forcing its way into the old kitchen and around the edges of the door to the room in which we sat. The flame in the kerosene lamp sitting in the center of the kitchen table flickered in response to the breath of Old Man Winter. The fires purred within the cook stove and the potbelly stove and up the chimneys. From time to time, something would pop inside the kitchen stove as though someone had dropped a kernel of popcorn into the fire. One of the cats sat on the cellar door outside, begging to come into the house. Without looking up or moving her hand away from her forehead, Grandma broke the silence by saying, "He can go under the house if he gets cold." It was as though she knew what I was thinking at that moment. Or perhaps we were both thinking the same thing. There was more silence, broken only by the rhythmic sound of the spirit that moves the clouds and sways the trees.
I think silence is almost a character in this book. They don't do a lot of talking. Now, the grandmother's a wonderful storyteller.
Isn't she wonderful?
We will talk about her,
wonderful
ability to tell stories, because that's an important component in the book. But so much of the time in the little cabin is spent in silence.
In silence, yes.
And you come to appreciate silence. And here is this little child, 8 years old, just learning to appreciate the stillness. And then, of course, in the stillness, he hears the birds singing, the wind blowing, the creek flowing, all those wonderful
natural
sounds.
That's exactly right. Yes.
And
yes.
What a wonderful way to grow up.
I think it is, yes. Uh-huh. I mean, it takes a long time of learning things like that, Rosemary, particularly if you live in those high plains areas, you know, where by listening to the wind, you know what the weather might be.
Yes.
It's mysterious, you know, that we don't see the wind. We never see the wind, but we always see the result of the wind. You know,
that's right.
Leaves rustling or grass bending, or we're aware of that.
Yes.
And how many times have we just sat and listened to nothing? And you listen real hard, And by golly, you can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You can hear it. It mm-hmm. pops up. Mm-hmm. You hear the bird.
So it's almost a form of meditation.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Perhaps that's why they were so centered and so grounded.
I think so.
Because they had time to be really at one with nature.
Yes.
It's so
yes.
impressive. And then, of course, the manifestation of the wind when it became one of those whirlwinds that are so common out there, not that common, but people on the prairie are not unaccustomed to the whirlwinds. We used to call them dust devils in
Kansas. Dust devils, yeah.
Right. Particularly at the time when they were at a funeral, they were in the cemetery. And then after a time where everyone was meditating and praying, one of those dust whirl manifestations came right to the cemetery. And everyone was so relieved because they said, that's a sign that the dead person's family have come to greet him and to accompany him into the next world.
Let's get on with it. Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah. What a beautiful interpretation.
Yes.
That is so comforting.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. And the dead are so present in their lives.
The dead are present, yes. And maybe the death is looked at as that whirlwind often because at least in some of the Lakota societies or some of those communities, once a person has walked what they call the Milky Way mm-hmm. into heaven, into the sparkle of stars, mm-hmm. once they've gone that trail— that they never again speak that person's name. That's a quiet name. It's that person is off to rest now. So you might speak about grandmother, but you wouldn't yeah. say their name. I don't know how it is in the modern day Sioux society, yeah. the Lakota people, mm-hmm. but in the old days, that's what happened. Yeah. Mm.
Sounds like a good custom to me. I mentioned that his grandmother, Bessie, was a wonderful teller of stories. And those stories are really important. In fact, they really highlight the book because
yes.
just as Joseph learned from his grandmother's story, we, the readers, learn from those stories. And I thought the writer has a great device here because without a lot of talking, there's not going to be much conversation. And so the interior monologue of Joseph is broken by the stories that his grandmother tells. And I wanted to read a couple of paragraphs about his grandmother.
Are you going to talk about how she sits?
Describe how she sits. That's so beautiful.
This was part of the book that mm-hmm. I had to go back and read several times. Mm-hmm. And I tried to do this.
Mm-hmm. So did I. Isn't
did you try
funny?
To do it?
Yes.
Could you do it?
Yes.
I thought about this mm-hmm. because my father would sit with his elbow in his yes. left hand and he put his hand over his mouth and he would look down. Now, that's very close to
yes,
what grandmother
what
would do.
Grandma Bessie did.
And my father's mother did the same thing. Mm-hmm. She was the Yankton Sioux. And I'm just wondering, you know, with this mm-hmm. war eagle and this... Mm-hmm. If it's a characteristic mm-hmm. that has been passed down, I don't know.
Maybe it's genetic.
Maybe it's genetic.
Here's a paragraph about grandmother's stories. Some experiences limit our trust in humanity, while other experiences transcend all time and events. Grandma's stories were like the latter, saddened by the memories of tragic and cruel inhumanity, and yet comforted and encouraged by the belief in the mystery of life, both here and beyond. It's like the voice of an owl sounding in the midst of a great whirlwind. It didn't matter how old Grandma was. It was the truth in her words that gave reason for celebration.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Yes, it is.
It also gives you another example of his beautiful writing. I mean, he's so gifted in his...
And there's at least two symbols there. Again, there's the whirlwind.
Yes.
And then there's the owl.
Yes.
And the owl, certainly with Lakota people, or in this case, the Yankton tribe, the owl is an omen.
Yes.
You should not look at the owl.
Ah.
It brings bad tidings.
Brings bad tidings, yes.
Yeah, there's mm-hmm. probably something out there is getting ready to get you and turn your toes up. Or at least someone that you might know.
Yes, and that's exactly what we learn as we go through the story when we come to the tragic part of it. The owl is the first thing that's introduced, and the grandparents know that something, either something bad has happened or is about to happen.
Yes.
Yeah. Grandma Bessie had bad eyesight. She had cataracts. And in those days and where she lived, they couldn't be treated.
Isn't that something?
It was so sad.
Yes.
And by the time they could get her someplace to be treated, it was too late.
That's true.
And,
yes.
Yeah. That was very sad. Well, I want to read a couple of paragraphs that are descriptive of Grandma. Grandma was a full-blood Sioux, a member of the Yankton tribe, who had lived on the reservation all her life. She was a tiny, frail-looking woman with long hair that was pinned up in a roll across the front and in a bun in the back of her head. Her soft voice seemed to match the frailness of her body. Yet she was a person who did things in a hurry and walked at a rapid pace. Her gentle dark brown eyes and the frown wrinkles on her forehead always reminded us of her kindness and how seriously she took most of life. When she looked down at the floor or covered her eyes with her hand and began to speak, everyone listened, for we knew that what she said was worth hearing and remembering.
Isn't that wonderful? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In one paragraph, you have Grandma.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, obviously, I fell in love with both the grandparents. They were now, Grandma Bessie had attended an Episcopal boarding school.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, Hope School for 10 years. And we're going to talk about Grandpa's experience at boarding school, too. But Grandma's experience was a little less punitive than Grandpa. The boys and girls were segregated. And they were punished for speaking their native language, and the boys' names were changed, but not the girls. She says they didn't bother to change our names.
Uh-huh.
And she was left-handed, and they kept trying to teach her to write with the other hand. Well, one day her father came to school, and it was the day on which she was being punished for writing with her left hand, and her left arm was tied behind her back. And so when her father showed up, her grandfather showed up, he was not pleased.
Yes.
And he took her home. And he said to her, bad things are happening out west. And he took her to see the ghost dance. That was so beautifully portrayed. I wasn't sure what a ghost dance was, of course. But, when you read this book, you forget all that stuff you've seen in movies. It's a spiritual gathering to celebrate the dead.
Exactly what it is.
And the description, extended description of what it was like for her as a child to go to that ghost dance is beautiful. And then only a few weeks later came the massacre at Wounded Knee, when the people who had gathered for that ghost dance were massacred by the troops.
Yes.
So, again, there's this flow from event to event. And as he looks back on it, you see how it all fits together.
And I think you often hear about oral history.
Yes.
With Native people.
Mm-hmm.
And for several reasons, there were a lot of them didn't use a pencil or a slate or whatever.
Right.
But they certainly knew their stories.
Yes.
I have heard the same stories so many times. You think, oh, my goodness, not again. Except the story might change a little bit. It's not word for word, and it depends on the storyteller. They will look at the audience, and if someone is out there and they're nodding their head, well, they might address that a little more and make that part of the story a bit larger. But basically, the story is the same.
Yeah.
It's teaching something or saying something.
Mm-hmm.
It might pass on what a ghost dance is all about or almost anything, how animals affect their lives and how many of them might even pick up an animal name.
Mm-hmm.
So those are important things, those stories.
It felt biblical to me because it was, at a preliterate time, not that no one could read or write, but the emphasis was on the spoken word and the transmission of knowledge and transmission of the important things in life was through these stories.
That's right, yes, yes. Yeah. And, often, the kids would, like you had mentioned, that they would be punished for speaking their language.
Yes.
sometimes I have heard in some of the boarding schools, particularly the off-reservation boarding schools, some of the kids, of course, when they're under the covers sleeping at night or off by themselves, they would speak their native tongue, even though they thought or may get caught.
They get in trouble for it.
They may get into big trouble for doing that. And like you say, this poor girl who was left-handed, having her left hand tied behind her back and going through the day like that.
Dreadful.
It's pretty tough.
Pretty tough.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like you to read the description of Grandpa. I have it marked here.
I was awakened early in the morning by Grandpa fixing the fire in the potbelly stove. Grandpa was a noisy person. Every time he did something, he made lots of noise. When he talked, he did so in a loud voice. When he slept, he snored loudly. Even when he walked heavily, and he didn't seem to care who heard him or who he woke up. Grandpa wasn't originally from the Yankton Reservation. In fact, he wasn't even Sioux. He was half Chippewa. Sometimes people say Chippewa, but he was half Chippewa and half French. When he was young, he had been a tall, straight man, but now he was old and stooped. His white, wavy hair accentuated his blue eyes that sometimes glared with sternness and strength and other times sparkled with mischief.
I think you're a storyteller. I mean, you read with such a... with such feeling.
I love that, Grandpa.
I do, too.
Yeah.
Now, Grandpa was Chippewa and French, and yet the grandson, Joseph, identifies himself as Sioux. Is it matriarchal society?
It's a matriarchal, yes.
Ah,
yeah, right on. Yes.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So when I was saying that I was related to War Eagle, it's through my grandmother's side.
Interesting.
So, yes, it's matriarchal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is Chuck Kensler, and we're discussing a book called Choteau Creek by Joseph Iron Eye Dudley. And we'll be right back.
To our elders who teach us of our creation and our past, so we may preserve Mother Earth for ancestors yet to come, we are the land.
This is dedicated to our relatives before us thousands of years ago, and to the 150 million who were exterminated across the Western Hemisphere in the first 400 years' time, starting in 1492.
To those who have kept their homelands and to the nations extinct due to mass slaughter, slavery, deportation, and disease unknown to them, and to the ones who are subjected to the same treatment today.
To the ones who survived the relocations and the ones who died along the way.
Well, we're back. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. My guest is Chuck Kensler, and the book that we're discussing is Choteau Creek, A Sioux Remembrance. Let me spell Choteau for you, so when you're looking it up to order the book, it's Choteau Creek. And the author is Joseph Iron Eye Dudley. He received that name at boarding school, or perhaps it's his father received the name Dudley. They thought he needed a different surname, not an Indian surname. And Grandpa did not have a good experience at boarding school at all, and he rebelled and ran away at some peril because they were severely punished if they were caught and brought back. You know quite a bit about these Indian boarding schools through family stories and your family. I think your father was at Haskell Institute in Kansas, am I right?
He was. He was at Haskell. He went there when he was started school.
Oh, my.
When he was seven, and that would have been in 1917. And then he went there until he graduated as a senior in high school. So he was there a long time. as well as his, he had one brother that started after him at high school, or at Haskell, I'm sorry. And the rest were sisters that he had, and then they went to what they call missionary schools that were reservation schools run by different orders of the religious orders. Mm-hmm. And they all thought they got pretty good educations. It was really quite an honor to go to Haskell.
Yes.
You just didn't go. You had to be selected to go.
Right.
But that didn't mean that you weren't picked up from the reservation and sent to an off-reservation boarding school, which is pretty tough when you're seven.
And they were not well treated.
Often they weren't well treated. I don't mean to go through and say the poor Indian, because my father often said that he got to do things in life because of his schooling at Haskell. Mm. But there were lots of stories that he would tell, like we all have stories of going to school. His mm-hmm. were the same, but some of them were not nice.
Yes.
They were pretty tough.
Mm-hmm. And the people who organized these schools seemed to be well-intentioned. The idea of civilizing, quote unquote, the Indians seemed to be a passion at that time, and that led to trying to get rid of the languages that were the first languages.
That's right.
Of these
yes.
children.
Yes.
And to cut their hair and dress them in the clothes that non-Indian children wore. In other words, to really deprive them of the marks of their racial identity.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yes. I think it happened with different tribes in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
The first Indian school that was organized was by a man that came out of the Civil War. His name was Richard Henry Pratt. He thought that he could work with the Indians, and he thought he could train Indians like he trained soldiers. So some older Indians, some of them that had been in the Civil War even, he took that group and used them as a model. And they started off, there was an industrial institute out there called Hampton Normal, and that was in 1878. And they called it a Negro school then, but it was a black school. And so they brought 17 of those kids. They were kids. They were 17 mm-hmm. to 20, something like that, ex-soldiers. But the kids at Hampton, the black kids, were afraid of the Indians.
Oh, my goodness.
So eventually they started Carlisle Indian School.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And that was in Pennsylvania, and that was in 1879. That was fairly successful. It was all boys. They used younger boys, they learned English, and like you say, they had their hair cut. They dressed as soldiers. They had military training plus technical training. And eventually, about the fifth school down, I think the second school after Carlisle was Shamawa up in Salem, Oregon. It was the second Indian school. Shamawa took West Coast Indians. Mm-hmm. Carlisle took most of the East Coast Indians. Mm-hmm. And the fifth school was Haskell.
Oh.
So Haskell is the oldest Indian school now.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's in Lawrence, Kansas.
In Lawrence, so Kansas. 1884 it was.
It would take the children in the middle of the country.
It took the kids in the middle of the country.
Oh. And so all the different tribes were mixed up together. Is that right?
They were all mixed.
Uh-huh.
Yes. When my father went there, he learned three or four of the other Indian languages. And he said he learned his Sioux really well there. It was a touch with home, be able to speak
yes.
their language.
Yes.
And of course, when they went to class, only English was spoken. If they were caught speaking any other tongue, they were severely punished
yes.
in some quite harsh ways.
Mm-hmm.
It depends if you were really a bad offender. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes you went to the guardhouse, and I always thought a guardhouse is where you kept guards, but it happened to be a place where they would put the kids for a while, girls as well as boys.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some pretty bad tales that came out of there. You know, you could drink water, and It was dark. It was scary.
Mm.
You know, you're a kid.
Yes.
What do you do?
Terrible.
You're just frightened for your life.
Yes. It's hard to even imagine such a thing. And it's hard to credit the people who ran those schools with good intentions when they were so severe.
I know. I was back at Haskell a few years ago, and I was collecting records on my father. And my father had a left thumb that was missing. And he had cut that off in a farming accident. The kids would do farming or some kind of a trade during the morning hours.
Yes.
And then in the afternoon hours, they would do schooling.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd start at 5 in the morning and go into 5 in the evening. So he evidently cut that off while they were baling hay or something like that. So when I picked up his records, I thought, geez, I'm going to find this out, you know, what year it happened and that kind of thing, because my father would never talk about it. Anyway, it ended up where there was no medical records on his thumb, although they had awards that he had gotten. His grades were there, his letters home. And
incredible.
So it made me think about how some of the kids way back in the old days got hung by their thumbs in this guardhouse. And I never really found out, you know. On the other hand, he might not have wanted me to know.
Yeah. And I do think that self-pity is not a characteristic of the Indians. I mean, there's so little complaint. That struck me in this book. I was thinking of children today, or I was whining about this and that. But not Joseph. I took that to be an important characteristic that they were emphasizing, to not feel sorry for yourself, to not complain, to accept life the way life is.
I think that's right, yes. Yeah. You know, how do you explain the scars on your back?
Exactly.
I mean, that's a private thing.
Exactly.
That belongs to you, and some scars are very deep. Mm-hmm. Those are for you. It's it's no one else's business.
Right. But the strength of character is impressive.
Yes.
Yes.
Grandma opened her big trunk, which sat in the corner near the foot of the folding bed. That was Grandma's trunk. She had bought it many years before. In the strongest and most literal sense, that trunk belonged to Grandma, and nobody opened it without her permission. Even Grandpa didn't open it except to help Grandma get something out or put something in it. In that trunk, Grandma stored some of her most memorable and precious belongings, including pictures of her relatives. The most impressive of these were the two large oval-shaped photographs of her uncles, her mother's cousins. There were precious pictures of Grandma and Grandpa's son, their firstborn, who had died when he was 1 year old. Other valuables in Grandma's trunk were contained in a shiny black chest with a white woman's picture on the cover. That chest was filled with photographs of persons who had been part of her circle of friends and extended family in years past. It was always difficult to separate the two groups, friends and extended family members. Two empty perfume bottles, along with two old Bibles, a book of common prayer, and three fancy handkerchiefs, were also kept in her trunk. That was the place where Grandma stored the decorations for the Christmas tree. It was really the only safe place in the house. There they could be stored throughout the year and not be broken. After removing the large wooden tray from the top part of the trunk, Grandma very carefully lifted a white box from the lower section and set it on the bed. She removed the cover in an almost sacred manner. Next, she turned back the soft blanket of cotton that covered the ornaments. They were as new and shiny as the year before, and the year before that one.
There are wonderful stories in this book. There are stories of the celebration of Christmas that just break your heart with joy, their pleasure over the smallest things, and the five presents that he gets every year: a pair of socks and a new pencil and things like that.
That's right. Yes.
Yes, and Grandma and Grandpa just exchange good wishes at Christmas, but they have a Christmas tree and they have a lovely day, and then his stories of Saturday, when they start out by going down to the creek and hauling buckets of water and bringing wood to build a fire, and they do the laundry and hang it out to dry, and then Joseph likes to take the water from the laundry and pour it over the linoleum floor
and mop
the floor.
Makes it look new again.
Makes it look new again, yes. And then Sundays when they walk the 2 miles to church carrying the food that they're going to share with others,
yes,
for lunch in flour sacks. It's such a lovely chronicle of their life. I think people would love reading this book. It's what I call a good read. You just settle into it and you know you're in good hands because the writer knows what he's doing. He knows how to tell this story. He knows how to develop his characters. He takes great pains to bring in the beautiful details of their daily life, of the birds, the animals, the fish, and the magic things that happen. Magic is not the right word. Supernatural doesn't do justice to it. It's a quality of life that most of us are just not familiar with. And another reason to read this book, to see how these marvelous supernatural events fit naturally into these lives.
Oh, it's an interlocking puzzle, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, all that fits together.
Yes.
For a reason.
Yes.
And sometimes, you know, you might not have the right piece to put in there.
Yes.
But someone mm-hmm. will give you the wisdom, mm-hmm. whether it's grandmother or mm-hmm. grandfather,
right,
to pick up the right piece and mm-hmm. show you how to put, mm-hmm. interlock those together. Mm-hmm. It never will come apart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that thread we talk about. It's
right.
It's actually locked together.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And Grandma and Grandpa got old. Eventually, they had to leave their beloved little house and move to town. Joseph went on with his education. He finished high school. He went to the Army Air Force. It was in the Air Force for, I think, 6-8 years.
Something like that, yes.
And then he went to seminary and became a United Methodist minister,
yes,
and the president of a college.
Can you imagine?
Yes.
That was in Tempe, isn't it? Or it is in Tempe.
Yeah, in Tempe.
Yes.
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 That part of the story is told more or less as an afterthought because, of course, most of the emphasis is on his early years.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. What I liked, and I've thought about this word so many times, Rosemary, is that a Sioux reminiscence.
Yes.
And I don't know, was it another word once? You know,
mm-hmm.
we say memoir now. Mm-hmm. We used to say memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is that mm-hmm. reminiscence?
It's bringing back. I interpreted this as his purpose in the book was to bring back those days and to share them with us. And then I was thinking about other ways that people have told the story. And of course, I thought of Sherman Alexie.
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness.
Whose
yes.
most recent book is called The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian.
I'm glad I don't have that tattoo on my arm.
And
that's
just
a long one.
Huh? Right. Won the National Book Award.
Yes.
And which just happens to take place in the same corner of the universe, or at least close.
They're in Spokane, Washington. Which is not too far away.
And that's close to where you grew up.
I spent part of my childhood close by.
Close by.
I lived on what they called the Yakima Indian Reservation.
Oh.
So we had moved from South Dakota to the state of Washington. My dad was working for the Bureau of Indian Affairs then.
Hmm.
So we know Spokane. Mm-hmm. You know, it's quite a beautiful city now. But that's where Sherman Alexie grew up. I think he's a Spokane Quarter Lane Indian, if I'm not mistaken,
mm-hmm.
but quite an interesting person.
Yes.
You know, he
yes. It's a wonderful book. It's breezy. It's bright. It's profane. It couldn't be more different from the other memoir that we've just been talking about. I think it would be very interesting for people to get different points of view on.
You would get a different point of view with Sherman Alexie. Yeah.
Yes, you would. Yeah. And could you mention some other? I mean, I'm constantly being asked. What else would you suggest that we read on this subject? And you probably have some suggestions for us.
If we're just talking about some of the, what I would call the Indian books, I would certainly, one of my very favorite is called Bead on an Anthill. And it's about a Lakota childhood, which is very similar, but this is a girl. Mm-hmm. Her name is Daphne Redshirt. Mm-hmm. And it's a memoir, and it talks about generations of Lakota women talking about their conflict in a bicultural world. She's a Lakota, but she grows up in Nebraska, and this is through the 60s and the 70s. Sherman Alexie in the diary book that you mentioned, he's about that same time.
Yes.
Whereas Chateau Creek was about the 40s and 50s.
Right, a generation.
Yeah,
or so
these,
earlier,
it's nice generations there. Mm-hmm. My very favorite book is Grandpa Was a Cowboy and an Indian, and it's by Virginia Driving Hawk Sneve, S-N-E-V-E. I just loved it because this was very, very Indian. And it goes there's a lot of narratives in there that are based on the oral traditions of the Lakota and Dakota mm-hmm. people. What I got out of that book is it's really tough to be young and have to decide if you're going to be white or Indian. And it's really easy to get mixed up about it.
That's
so
right.
He was a person of mixed blood.
Uh-huh.
Did I say that was my favorite? Because this is my favorite.
That's okay. You can have more.
Neither Wolf nor Dog.
Oh, yes. I've heard you speak of this book.
It's written by a white man named Kenneth Nerburn, N-E-R-B-U-R-N. And he meets with a Lakota man out of South Dakota and wants to do his life story. This is a good push-shove for both of them. So they visit Elder Sue, and then they go through Indian towns and white roadside cafes and down these forgotten roads. Like you had mentioned, there's the Road of the Ghost Dance and road that Sitting Bull was on.
Hmm.
And this is just it's just loud humor. You just have to laugh. There's nothing you can do about it. Maybe another person that's really close to home here is Greg Saris.
Of course. I think of him as our very own Greg Saris.
He grew up here, yes, mm-hmm. and he went to the local schools and the JC and UCLA and a PhD mm-hmm. from Stanford.
Yes.
And he's written everything from poetry. His Watermelon Nights was great. He did a short story called Grand Avenue, which became a movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's got an exceptional book. It's a collection of short stories called The Sounds of Rattles and Clappers.
Yes.
And that's men and women, Indian mm-hmm. people who have these wonderful stories. Mm-hmm. A good place to start. Mm-hmm. That's very good. Mm-hmm. So I could go on and on mm-hmm. about all his books.
I know. He's a very important person in the literary community here. Right.
One of my favorite authors is a man named Ian Frazier.
Oh, I love Ian Frazier.
Do you? Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
Yes.
He's very, very good.
And he's funny.
So we're talking about Sherman Alexie here, mm-hmm. but Sherman Alexie, he's got a nice way of saying things. Sometimes he's a little bit gritty, but he talks about writing and having the experience of living on a reservation from an Indian standpoint. And he says, but you can be a good writer and you can visit a reservation and write like Ian Frazier does. And I always thought Ian Frazier was an Indian, but he's not.
No.
He's
mm-hmm.
not an Indian, mm-hmm. but he visits and mm-hmm. that doesn't set well with Sherman Alexie.
Right.
He thinks you need really need the experience.
Yeah, well, I can understand both points
sure,
of view. Right.
But he's a great writer.
Yes, yeah. Yes, he is.
Reedy and
yes,
Fraser, yeah.
Yes.
So those are some of the ones that I would.
And you yourself are writing. I know you've written a number of stories about your father. I'd ask if you'd bring some of your work to read so we could get just a feel for your writing. Would you do that?
Yes, I can. And I preface it by saying my father, Short Buffalo, was born in 1910 on the Cheyenne River Indian Agency in South Dakota. When he was 7 years old, he went to Haskell Institute. It's an off-reservation boarding school in Lawrence, Kansas. This is the first part of the story. One windless day, I put my slingshot, an eagle bone whistle, and a knot of hair from my horse Brownie into a flour sack. My mother gave me a small family photograph. She had penciled the numbers 1917 on the back. A white man in a black car with a Bureau of Indian Affairs shield on the door took me away. Haskell was a stomach-twisting, heart-tearing government boarding school for Indians. We arrived with proud, taut looks, decorated clothes, buckskin leggings, and beaded moccasins. Some of us had face paints, braided hair, and a twist of sweetgrass. We stood as white hands hacked off our hair. It piled on the floor along with other piles of black lost pride. My mother made moccasins were burned. I hoped ants would hide the red, green, and yellow beads in their sandy heels. We had sad eyes, chopped hair, clothes we'd grow into, shoes too big, neckties and high stiff collars strangling our necks. We would have tears, but never cry out loud. We learned the white way without libraries, music, or art. We learned not to talk with our teachers, only answer. We learned suspicion and mistrust and to fight each other in frustration. We learned that once you have been discriminated against, it never goes away. And we learned to reject our heritage, which nearly killed us.
Well, that's powerful.
You know, it is powerful, and it's so true.
Well, it's time to wind this up. Thank you, Chuck, for helping me out today.
It's been lovely. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
What a nice night.
You've been listening to A Novel Idea. The book is Choteau Creek, A Sioux Remembrance by Joseph Iron Eye Dudley, published by the University of Nebraska. And my guest is Chuck Kensler. I want to remind everyone that the Sonoma County Book Festival is coming up. It will happen on Saturday, September 19th in Courthouse Square in downtown Santa Rosa. Mark the date. Among the featured writers will be Dr. Mark Sloan, local Kaiser pediatrician, author of a book called Birthday. Mark was my guest on Novel Idea, and you can hear this show on your computer. Go to the website, krcb.org, go to radio, and go to Novel Idea. All our recent shows are available there. The Literary Arts Guild will host a fundraiser for the book festival on Saturday, the 1st of August. The event will take place at Windrush Farm, which is Mimi Luberman's ranch west of Petaluma. Guests will have the opportunity to savor Mimi's famous handmade pizzas baked in her wood-burning oven. And Jonah Raskin will read from his latest book, Field Days, a year of farming, eating, and drinking wine in California. Jonah will talk about his adventures working in the fields at Oak Hill Farm in Glen Ellen, and some of the folks from Oak Hill Farm will be there with him. You'll have the opportunity to buy Jonah's book, and he'll sign it for you. For more information, you can go to the website for Sonoma County Book Festival. And to find out more and make your reservations, you can call J.J. Wilson at 795-9028. That's the fundraiser for this year's Sonoma County Book Festival. My thanks to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show. This is Rosemary Manchester reminding you there's no such thing as too many books.